afternoon. It's Brian Gerrish here with another edition of Dispatches, and I'm going to be talking to three people this afternoon. I've got a gentleman called Mark, and I've got two ladies. I've got Shirley and I've got Sylvia, and we are going to be discussing the situation of care in the United Kingdom. Now, some of this impinges, of course, on care homes. We're particularly focused here on the elderly. Care homes, residential homes, but this also links into the main NHS system itself. And I'd like to start off today by just having a little recap with Mark, because Mark and I spoke a couple of weeks ago, where he began telling me about what he discovered about care within the so-called care system. And some of the events which he discovered, some of the evidence which he has discovered, point to the fact that we are now at a stage, not that elderly people are just being neglected within the system, but what we are starting to see are deaths caused by either neglect or willful neglect within the system. And Mark has encapsulated some of that under the title of Mechanics of Modern Murder. So Mark, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. And I wonder whether you can just tell our listeners just a little bit, how have you got involved in this subject, and where has it led you? And then could you just introduce the two ladies that you've got with you today?
Okay, well, I got involved in this because of my own mother. She had a stroke in 2010, which at the time seemed reasonable. As I did further investigation, it didn't make sense. They claimed she had dementia. She didn't have dementia. Later on, they claimed other things, and I watched the whole system lie about my mother. And I'm a medical researcher, so I could back up what I saw were clear lies. And then the most shocking thing was I pointed out these lies and they were ignored by a sheer wall of denial, which is just incredible. It's just profoundly disturbing. And then when my mum died, as I rooted through the evidence, we had a hospital saying she wasn't on a pathway. We have a hospital then saying she was on the pathway. And then we have a CQC report, which clearly states my mum was never on the pathway, and this is the pathway to death. And they said my mum couldn't swallow. I saw my mum, she clearly could swallow. They restricted my access to my mother, so I could only see her three times a week for 1 hour, with two social workers who prevented me from videoing, recording, or showing any alternative evidence. And they blocked my mum from seeing independent, supportive people who could prove what was going on. It is clearly very, very wrong.
And Mark, what sort of care home was your mother in? Was that a private care home, or was it connected to a local authority?
I don't want to mention, because I know you've got to edit this, but it was a company-run care home which is listed, and they obviously were in the pocket or were financially gaining through NHS contracts.
Right, so essentially a private care home.
Yes.
Okay, and just in however much detail as you want to do, but we're going to keep things short today. What sort of things were you observing around your mother?
Well, I am technically a whistleblower, because from 2010 to 2013, my mum kept improving as I kept seeing her. Then in 2014, I went in at night. I saw a nursing home with no support, no staff. This was because they were running a critical care unit, which was taking patients from the local hospitals, A&E. The nursing staff very kindly told me that's why they were understaffed. But what I saw at night was truly disturbing. I saw what I believe was something called bed turning, where an elderly person was left lying on their stomach, so their face and head was lying into a pillow, so they would suffocate. I was then blocked from visiting the place at night. I saw at mealtimes people being given non-thickened foods. and fluids, so that was very bad, and I was blocked from meal times. It's just very bad, yeah?
Okay, and I know this is a very sensitive subject, so what did your mother die from?
Well, this is the problem. According to the autopsy report, there's an indication she was starved in the nursing home, starved and dehydrated. That's what we've managed to get an independent person to see, and because of that, that's where we're going. But the coroner destroyed evidence, and that is the fact. There was 200 millilitres in my mother's stomach in the autopsy, and that should have been analysed, because I did accuse the nursing home of poison, and instead the coroner destroyed the evidence.
Right. So dehydration and starvation.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I saw. I saw my mum slowly becoming thinner, wanting to live, wanting to escape that place, trapped in a bed, which she didn't need to be, put on morphine when she didn't need it for any clinical reason, other than she was obviously getting better. And it's very similar to what's been shown on BBC Panorama recently. But the fact is, it's just the fact that the whole network of corruption from the local council to the police to the coroner occurred, and then as you go around talking to lawyers, they know this is going on and there's no action to stop it. I went to inquest.org.uk and they know of the coroner as being a bad egg. This coroner is not, you know, this is very troubling, yeah?
Right, okay. And you start to investigate for more evidence. You're talking to more and more people.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people start to approach you. They see your information and they start to approach you. What sort of things do those people say to you?
Okay, well, I started Facebook and Twitter. And what I slowly got was more and more people coming forward with these issues, and it went from one person a week to three or four people in a week, and all the same stories, loved ones being removed, and just shocking events occurring, and then the legal or whatever ignoring what was being done, yeah?
Right, and what sort of numbers, one or two, or...?
Well, if you go on my Twitter account, which is Dr. Jones AA, it's quite large. I mean, my own petition for my mother, which is on change.org, you've got 900 people at the moment. But if you read the comments section, it is appalling, yeah?
Right. Okay. And ultimately, that trail has led you to come into contact with the two ladies that you have with you.
Yes.
This afternoon. So I'm going to say hello to Shirley and Sylvia.
Hi.
Hello there. And can I ask one of you to start and tell us how did you get in contact with Mark, and what is your own what is your own story in this area?
Well, when I started to see Mark's tweets, I realized that it was not only me; there were other people as well involved in this thing. Because I had my sister, who was not in a home, in a care home, but she was in a hospital, and she was dehydrated, and I have no doubt that she was put on the LC on the pathway, and basically murdered.
Right. So the pathway being the Liverpool care pathway.
Yes, she was taken to hospital with a stomach ailment, and that should have been good enough she should have been cured with some antibiotics. Instead, they bent on a whole rigmarole of saying she's got TB. They sent her to another hospital about 300 miles away. The family couldn't visit her because they were working. And every time the family said, we're going to see her this weekend, oh, no, no, she'll be back. She'll be back by Friday. She'll be back on Saturday. And for two whole weeks, nobody saw her. When they brought her back, she was emaciated. and she was like a dark grey colour, and she died within hours.
When you say that she was brought back, where
she was brought back to the hospital,
where did they bring her to?
She was in a hospital that had initially admitted her. She was then sent off to another hospital, and the family couldn't have any contact with her for 2 weeks. They then brought her back to the hospital where she was originally admitted, and when she came back, she died within hours.
Right. And I know this is a very emotional subject, but how long was it from the time that she went into hospital to the time that she actually died?
Well, it was about three to 4 weeks.
Right. And were you able to speak to people? Did you express your concerns as to what was happening to medical staff?
Well, her family did, because she was in another city. She was in Wales, and I was in London, and I was at the time recovering myself in hospital.
Right.
So what I got was from her son, my nephew, and these are the things that he told me. And when he called me first and said, they've brought back mum back to the hospital. We've just been to see her, but they say that she doesn't have long to live. Then he described her to me as to what she looked like. And I immediately realized that something was not right. He then called me about 45 minutes later and said the hospital had called him back and they were going to see her again. By the time they reached the hospital, she was breathing her last. The priest was there giving her the last rites. And she passed away within minutes of that.
And how did you start to get involved after her death? Because I believe that you've spent a great deal of time trying to understand what had happened.
Well, things were not quite right. They refused to release her body. They kept her body for, I think, something like 12, 14 days. And just excuses that we need this, we need that. Eventually, they said they needed the date of birth of her husband. He had passed away 25 years earlier. So we then had to find, none of us, we knew his birthday, but not the year that he was born. Anyway, we got that from the marriage certificate. And when we said we could send the hospital the photocopy of the marriage certificate, they then released the body after they had ascertained that she would be cremated. But she wasn't cremated. And the problem, what niggles me, is that when I went to attend the funeral, the coffin was very small. It was like the coffin of a child. And I immediately said that my sister was not that short. Something is wrong here. What is happening? So I called the undertaker, and I said, I want to see my sister's body. And he said, it's been such a long time since she has passed away, we would advise you not to see it. So I never actually saw my sister's body, but I do know that the coffin was shorter, about 10 inches shorter than it should have been.
Right. And the inference from that is that she was severely emaciated and thus...
Well, Brian, I don't think the skeleton, and I'm going a bit morbid here, but I don't think the skeleton would be...
The skeleton doesn't shrink.
It doesn't shrink.
So this is a very important point here. When we look at the deaths occurring on the Liverpool Care Pathway, or the pathway to death as it's been reframed as, one of the most common patterns is... The loved ones are removed from the patient, The patient is isolated. It's generally 3 or 4 weeks. They die. You don't have access to the body for another period of time, which makes no sense. And then at the funeral, the body is always seems to be shorter than the original person. And it is significant. Right. And the explanation could be that they're using a coffin, which is a standard size coffin, they try and fit the body in. But that doesn't make sense either, because you can't fold the legs up that far. So something else is going on to reduce the size of the person. And that is a mystery, because that seems to be sort of a common occurrence with these cases.
Right. Well, Brian, I'd like to bring in another concern of mine. You remember the broadcaster Alistair Cook? He passed away in New York. Several months or years, I think, after his death, his family was told that they have his leg bones. He was cremated, but they returned his leg bones to the family, saying that they had found his leg bones. So right. This is really morbid, but I had known about this story about Alistair Cook, and it worries me that why was my sister's coffin so small?
Yes. Well, I have to say that I have other cases that I've been informed about where bodies have been returned to the families incomplete. And in some of those cases, families have spent years trying to track down a variety of body parts, which ultimately have been found spread in hospitals all across the country. So that one subject is something that requires quite some discussion on. Certainly I've heard it before. I'm going to just to finish off before ask Shelley.
Well,
hang
on, one last thing. Could you mention what the undertakers wrote to you, please?
Well, I wrote to the undertaker and I asked him to describe to me exactly what condition he found my sister's body. He phoned my nephew, who had been dealing with him, and said, "Your aunt has just written a letter to me. I don't want to get involved with this. There's stuff going on, and I want to shut down this business. I can't take it anymore." Although he still is practicing. My sister died in 2013. The undertaker is still doing his business. But at that time, he told my nephew that he was seriously thinking of shutting down.
Because why was he going to shut down?
Because of what was going on with people's bodies.
And I think that's another common pattern here, that a lot of the people who've lost their loved ones, when they have interactions with family undertakers, the family undertakers are seeing things which they have never previously had to deal with, and then they become very unable to explain what they're seeing. But there's something else going on here, which is very unpleasant.
Okay, we'll come back to that point, Mark. Let's just bring in Sylvia.
Hello, Brian. I think before I start, your audience needs to be aware that Shirley's sister was on holiday.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Go and explain. Sorry.
Yes, my sister was on holiday. She had come from abroad to visit her son and to visit me because I was having some surgery when she got ill. And later on, they discovered that she was a foreigner here. So they told my nephew that they were going to send him a bill. He said, "Well, she has travel insurance." And they turned around and told him, "Well, now you tell us."
Right.
I think the point is that people who are visiting England may have to be wary. Okay. Go ahead.
The inference is that they're receiving special treatment, or we could say non-treatment, but they're marked in some way. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying there's something else going on. I don't have any of the answers. I just find patterns which aren't very, very pleasant. So I'll let you continue.
Well, okay. Brian, I think that, you know, there are some sort of cash incentives to the hospitals or to the trusts, and people are just eager to build up on their takings. So they as soon as they realize that there's someone they can, excuse the term, bump off, they would do it because of the cash incentives. It's a very cynical procedure that people go through in hospitals. I've had my own story, which I'll tell you later. But okay. I had three brushes with LCP myself.
Okay.
Anyway,
well,
I'll pass you over to you.
So if we move on.
Hello, Brian. Yeah, my experience goes back to 2010 when my mother was first diagnosed with dementia. From the minute she got into that system, as LPAs, my sister and I were both LPAs, and the Mental Capacity Act is very clear that LPAs should be spoken to as if the donor.
Right, and one of the tell our listeners what LPA stands.
It's power of lasting power of attorney.
Right.
I'd been my mother's lasting power of attorney since I was 23, 24 years old, so for like 30-odd years. Once she was deemed to lack capacity, the LPAs were totally bypassed. We weren't included in her care and treatment. She was given medication with no consent, no discussion, more often than not. All the authorities and the care homes excluded our mother in most of her decisions, unless they were simple decisions, like what does she like to eat? And even that, at the end of her life, she passed on the 13th of October this year in hospital. She wasn't allowed her cultural food for nearly 7 months before she passed. Now, that is breach of Regulation 14. The CQC are not interested. The CCG are not interested, who funded her care under NHS full nursing funding. The local authority were not interested. In fact, nobody is interested in these breaches and nobody does anything. Your viewers may not know that we all get pushed to go and complain to the CQC, but the CQC does not accept individuals' complaints. So actually, we as relatives who visit our loved ones every single day, I visited my mum every day for 4 years while she was in the care home system, we have nowhere to go, nowhere to get support. We are constantly accused and counter-accused as soon as we raise care issues, and we're either banned or are restricted to seeing our loved ones, or they give them notice to quit. My mum had notice to quit twice in two care homes, and I ended up in the Court of Protection, taken there by the CCG, who was the funding body. But this all started the minute she went into a care home. The first care home she went into, her social worker raised six safeguarding issues. Of course, none of them were substantiated. Three of them we didn't even know about, and this evidence is that relatives and LPAs are not included in the process, which they're supposed to be. And I think fundamentally, we've got legal frameworks, we've got the Mental Capacity Act, we've got NHS legal rights, but nobody enforces them or upholds them. And then we are left out in the cold and in the dark and counter-accused as relatives. So my mum lost two care home positions, and I was made the made to blame because I was raising issues in the care home. My mum got nine fractures, unknown caused fractures, between August 2013 and recently, when she was admitted to hospital where she died, and she was found to have three fractures in her left leg. In the hospital, they found this. Now we have a situation where the safeguarding of three authorities are passing the buck backwards and forwards. I'm absolutely certain the fractures did not happen in hospital. Therefore, by default, they must have happened in the care home. Well, they've turned this safeguarding down, said it's unsubstantiated, so my mum had three fractures that nobody's interested in. And this is what you find is a common issue all the time, Brian. And it's been like this from day one going into a care home.
This subject is a great interest to me because I have a lady who is a solicitor, has worked in amongst healthcare claims for several years. And she has said to me recently that, in her opinion, the NHS regards itself as above the law.
Yes.
So in trying to take compensation claims or claims for negligence against the NHS. This particular solicitor has found that the NHS will repeatedly do simple things, will stall, deny receiving letters or emails, take very long time to reply.
Yes.
But also, they are prepared to do that when faced with documentation, which is legal documentation, which would ultimately form evidence in a court of law.
Yes.
And she was very, very interesting because she said that she had increasingly been faced with hostility from family and friends of the deceased because they believed that initially, at least, that it was her that was causing the delay. She wasn't doing her job as a solicitor. And she said she eventually got to the point where the pressure from these families was so strong it was starting to affect her ability to do her job. And she said, I decided one day the only thing I could do was to really tell these families what I knew about procedures within the NHS and the fact that, in her opinion, the NHS was prepared to simply ignore or break the law in order to cover its tracks. And what was interesting was the lady then said to me that the moment she'd done this, the reaction from the family members changed dramatically in that they then became much more ready to deal with her, give her information. She was almost treated as a friend. And, of course, they realised, those families realised that she was doing her best as a solicitor, but she was faced with a body which, in her opinion, was actually out of control. So that area you've raised, I can reinforce straight away.
Okay, the issue, Brian, it's not just solicitor. Yes, it's not just NHS England. It's NHS England, it's the CCGs, it's the CQCs, it's the local authorities. They are all complicit. None of us can afford to go to a court. When our relatives are in danger, we don't have time to go to court. We don't have the money to go to court. And legal rights and legal frameworks like the Mental Capacity Act and NHS legal rights should not require a solicitor to uphold their rights, especially when there's substantive evidence. In my case, I had nearly 100 photographs of poor care that I sent to all those bodies, and not one of them has even acknowledged that those photographs of poor care even exist.
Mm.
Yes.
And this is what you're up against. You're pushed from one to the other. You can't take legal action because you don't have any money. Solicitors aren't interested because you have to prove pain and suffering. If you've managed to divert a near miss by being on the case every day like I was, then you get accused of abuse, you get accused of harassment, you get accused of being the problem. And then they turn on the relatives. And
of course, many people ultimately get banned from the particular care home so that they can't see and protect their relative.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Care homes are private property. They can kick off anybody they like and they can make any reason. One of the care homes called the police on me. They accused me of harassing and abusing the staff. I didn't even know they'd called the police. The police turned up. This was Christmas Eve 2014, and the police asked me to leave. And actually, the policeman was very nice. He said, look, I'm so sorry. He said, I can see there's an issue here with the management of this care home. He said, I don't want to ask you to leave. He said, because I know you're with your mother. He said, but they've told us you've done this, and they are private property. We have to ask you to leave. We have no choice.
Right.
They could not ask any witness what was going on. They could not discuss the issue, and the reason they'd called the police was because I'd raised a concern about a one-to-one nurse that was with my mum who was refusing to change a dressing on my mum's finger, and she was eating with her fingers because she has dementia, and the dressing on her finger, she had a crushed finger which the same nurse had crushed in a wheelchair the day before and reported it as a minor cut. It was a crush. She lost her fingernail in April 2015. And I have photographs of the nail dropping off, and everybody denied that it was anything other than a minor cut. So this nurse, on this night, the 24th, accused me of abusing her because I asked her to change the dressing and she refused. So I said that she was neglecting my mum because she was refusing to change the dirty dressing that was going in her mouth. And the deputy manager called the police and said, "You're harassing my staff." But that was after she waved a poster in my face saying that you're not allowed to abuse and harass staff. And yes. I think constantly, relatives are provoked constantly. You're not allowed to be upset. You're not allowed to be angry because that is more ammunition for them to use against you. And it doesn't matter what you say or what you do. You have no witnesses as a relative visiting in a care home. You are totally isolated. You have nobody to go to. There's a zillion organisations out there, Brian, that say they'll help. They do not help. They do not give practical help. What they do is signpost you and keep you going round in circles forever. And what happens, you go to a care home and you say, "Look, I'd really like you to address this. I wasn't allowed access to care plans. There was no person-centred care. My mum wasn't allowed the food that she liked." All the things that we're promised and assured is just rubbish, Brian. It's just ignored, and it's ignored with impunity because none of the authorities who are controlling or funding the care home, they're desperate for beds. They don't want to upset the care homes. They're desperate.
What did you... So your mother had dementia.
Yes.
So you're talking about the neglect over quite a protracted period. What did she actually die of?
That's a very good question, Brian, because what she died of is what the doctor says she dies of. That doesn't necessarily mean it's true. But you can't question the doctors because they're professionals, and any time you raise any questions, you're accused of challenging. So any information that you seek, you're blocked, even as an LPA. They don't want to give you medical records. They don't want to give you care reports. They withhold everything, and we can't get our rights exercised. They said my mother died of aspiration pneumonia, stroke, dementia, and atrial fibrillation. They wouldn't even tell me when the inquest was. I had 5 or 6 phone calls with the coroner's court. They wouldn't. It took me 2 weeks to find out the inquest date. They left it till 2 days before the inquest. Now, my mum was under dole, so it should have been an Article 2 inquest.
And that's the same for me. If it's Article 2, it should be a public inquest, and I went through all the same issues here, and also my local MP was useless. Was your MP any good?
I didn't talk to my MP about this latest issue, but I did involve my MP, who is Jane Ellison. She wasn't interested in any of the issues at the previous care home. And the death certificate, Brian, they cremated my mum before the inquest.
Pardon me?
They cremated my mum before the inquest. I went to the inquest 48 hours after they told me when it definitely was. They confirmed that it was on the 27th. I went into court. I swore an oath to tell the truth. There was only myself and the judge in court. Before I went to court, I sent corrected documents because the doctor had sent a document for a Dole's, not a Dole's, for an inquest. It wasn't an Article 2 inquest. It was just an inquest. Nobody's told me why it wasn't an Article 2, because my mum was under Dole's in the hospital because she lacked capacity. There's been no answers to any questions. I still don't have the permanent death certificate. I only have the temporary one they issued beforehand, which I had to keep calling them about. I said to the judge in court, "Have you got the documents in front of you?" Because I edited the factually incorrect information of the report that they sent me like 24 hours beforehand that the doctor had written, which had the wrong date of death, the wrong place of residence. They said my mother's place of residence was the doctor's surgery. I mean, it was just totally incompetent, the report, and lots of other factually incorrect information. So I sent it back with all the facts corrected, plus other information about my mother's death. The judge didn't even have a copy in front of him. He said, "Oh, we've changed the date of birth and date of death, so it's correct, and we've changed her residency, so it's correct." I said, "What about all the other information I put in that report?" He said, "I don't need that other information." I said, "Well, I'm here swearing on oath. And my oath is I was with my mum when she died. No doctor was with my mum when she died. She died at 1:20 in the morning. They reported that she died at 1:30. And I said, she didn't die of a stroke. He said to me, "You're not medically qualified." I said, "No, I'm not. but I was with her. She did not die of a stroke because she was unconscious the whole day, and that leads to other issues because he gave a drug that I think killed her at the end. And then he said to me, well, you don't have any evidence. And I said, but you don't have any evidence that she died of a stroke either.
Right.
And he shut me up. He just said, well, that's what the doctors said. And I felt like saying to him, well, you know, Shipman signed a lot of death certificates too, and he was a doctor.
Right. Just to reinforce what you're saying, I've been in dialogue with a lady, Plymouth area, who on a particular third-party friend who has died, there is actually two death certificates, and they're different. But the local coroner is not interested in this very interesting situation, and neither are the police. So if anybody is listening to this at the moment and thinking, well, that can't be true, I can give another first-hand example here that death certificates seem to have become fairly fluid documents where information can be wrong. That may be a mistake, but when we come to two different death certificates, obviously something a lot more serious is going on.
Well, I think it goes on much further than that, Brian. My mum was in a care home before she went into hospital, obviously. I wrote to the care home the day before she went into hospital and requested twice for her to see a GP, and I raised issues that I felt she was infected. She had an infection. I'd been raising issues for a week. The doctor refused to come out, apparently. I don't know, because the doctor didn't speak to us as the LPA or the next of kin. She prescribed drugs for my mum with no consent, no discussion, no options, no care or treatment options, which is an NHS legal right. Now, if you speak to the NHS, nobody can enforce the NHS legal rights under the Constitution except a court. What is the point of having legal rights that can't be enforced or upheld, that people ignore repeatedly? LPAs, they come under the Mental Capacity Act. They are supposed to speak to us as if we are the donor. That's why we become powers of attorney. Everybody ignores you. And if you say anything at all, well, you're not a doctor. You're not clinically trained. And when I expressed my mum's views, the common response was, oh, well, you don't know how she's feeling now because she's got dementia. She may have changed her mind. The whole point of having a power of attorney is to relay that person's wishes, which is what they wanted and what they made you a power of attorney for, to express their expressed wishes. But nobody seeks them, nobody is interested, and nobody cares. Before my mum was admitted to hospital, she was given several lots of drugs over a period of a year for clinical heart failure and high blood pressure. Our mother did not suffer with high blood pressure. The hospital confirmed that. They also confirmed she did not suffer with clinical heart failure. But the doctor was prescribing drugs because she said she could diagnose clinical heart failure. She refused to send my mum to a cardiologist. My mother's ECG and echocardiogram was normal for her age, and she had standalone atrial fibrillation. The doctor has total power. The care home ignored the fact that the doctor would not speak to the relatives. So the doctor was coming in, doing exactly what she wanted to do, making my mother weaker with various drugs that my mother wouldn't have wanted because she was very sensitive to drugs anyway. On the Saturday she went into hospital, she had angioderma. She had face swelling, lip swelling, and eye swelling, an adverse reaction from the drugs she'd been given 3 days earlier with no consent.
Right.
Perhaps, Brian.
I'm just going to say, let's bring Mark back in here, because Mark, you have heard a large number of people talk about similar circumstances around the death of particularly elderly.
Well, it's on my Twitter. You've got
what have you been picking up? What are the common factors?
I think deaths. I think what happens is people contact me Twitter or via Facebook, and they relay very similar stories of their loved one being removed from what they think is being done, should be done right for them, that the care plan doesn't seem to make sense, the medication they've been given doesn't make sense, which is quite strange, you know, because you're dealing with very qualified people who should know what they're doing, but there seems to be a disagreement. And then if you listen to what Shirley talks about with her own issues when she's been in the hospital, which might be a good thing to do, you suddenly realise they prescribe, in your case, stuff for your stomach, did you say?
Yeah.
Can Shirley come in, yeah?
Yes, of course.
Go and explain what happened with you, because you didn't have a stomach problem, did you? Explain.
No, I went in for a total knee replacement. I was given blood thinners to inject, which I later found out that I didn't really need blood thinners to inject. I know perhaps they thought I needed blood thinners, but tablets would have been fine. I was given 24 injections to self-inject. I had no reason to question it. I injected 4 of those in the hospital, and then I came home and I injected another 12. I then called the doc, the hospital, and said, look, I still have some injections left, but I cannot find any place on my abdomen to continue injecting it because my abdomen is all bruised. So they said, well, don't have it anymore. After a while, after I think a few weeks, I had a rectal bleeding. It wasn't actually blood. It was like a viscous, very dark red substance, which when it happened at about 2 in the morning, I called NHS Direct, and they said that we are going to send the ambulance for you. Keep the door open, and you need to go to the hospital immediately. So they sent me, the ambulance came, took me to the hospital, and I was in intensive care for, I think, several hours. There was a junior doctor there, God bless him, who stayed by my bedside. And he was there the whole day coming and looking in on me. I was then moved to another part of the hospital where I was put into a private room. The room next door had a gentleman who was, I think, about to pass away. He had his relatives around him, several doctors, several nurses. And while I was in my room, a nurse came in and she locked herself up in my toilet and she was crying. And I realized that she was crying because of what was happening to the gentleman next door. And there was a lot of noise and stuff going on there. Eventually, a consultant came and he said, I've been looking for you and you're here. I said, well, I've been brought to this part of the hospital. I didn't ask to be brought here. So he said, well, we're going to refer you for a colonoscopy. And he went away. And the junior doctor told me, leave your door open and leave the blinds up. He said, I said, that's all right. He said, no, leave your door open. And it then occurred to me, because I had already heard about what was happening in hospitals, that me being in this private room wasn't a safe option. I didn't sleep all night because I was afraid that they might come and do me in. So anyway,
right.
I was later the next day I was taken to the ward, and it was a lot of sort of unexplained things, like the food I was given was not what I had asked for. I was given a ham sandwich, which knocked me out for a while. I suspect that there was something in the ham sandwich, because as soon as I ate it, I fell asleep, and when I woke up, there were all kinds of in sort of like drips going into my arm and stuff like that. Anyway, I sent a text message to my family. They came immediately and they stayed with me till I was well enough to leave. I left there, I think, on the fourth day. But while I was there, it was horrendous. They was constantly trying to give me medication that I didn't need, and I was constantly saying I'm not going to take this because I don't know what they are.
Forgive me. When was your husband with you when you were given the sandwich?
Yeah, my husband was with me and he fell asleep as well.
So you were both given, this is peculiar, but you were given a sandwich, but your husband fell asleep and you both fell asleep at the same time.
We fell asleep at the same time.
Which could be a coincidence.
Could be a coincidence. But there have been several incidents where things have happened when I've been in hospital. I've had this rectal bleeding three times, and each time it has happened after I have been to hospital.
Right.
I've never had it before, and I've not had it since.
One other thing. Didn't you say you went to see your GP and he tried to prescribe something else to do with...
Yes, I went recently. I've been referred again for surgery to my knee, but I was given what was the name of the medication?
Medication for reflux, acid reflux.
For acid reflux.
Which you don't have.
I don't have acid reflux. I've never had it, and I don't know why they've given me that along with pain, very high dosage painkillers. So I've been doing some research on that, and I'm concerned. You know, I'm going to digress a little bit here, Brian. You see, there's the system in the whole country, whether it's banking, whether it's health, whether it's schools, whether it's children-related, there are cash incentives in place to, even if you're on job seeker's allowance, to make sure that people are kept in their place. And I don't know if you've seen this film, Daniel Blake. That deals with that for the JSA people. The banking people who have been stung by their banks don't get any redress because it's very difficult. The FCA might say that, you know, the bank is at fault, but the account holder cannot ask the bank to pay. And it's you're up against a brick wall no matter where you are. You're up against a brick wall because people are being paid money to keep quiet. And it's the whole rotten system which we are fighting here, not just the NHS. The whole system is wrong.
This is an extremely good point. But I want to ask a question, and I'm prompted here by the fact that the topic we're talking about is very, very serious, and I know a lot of people will be very disturbed to hear of events happening, which means that they or their relatives could be at risk within the NHS. Now, obviously, you've both described all of you have described having interactions with staff who were not doing their job. Did you get any support from other members of staff who were concerned or showed that they were doing the right things?
Well, not all the staff is rotten. There's a group I noticed in the few times that I've been to hospital that there are groups of people who come out of the woodwork at night, mm-hmm. and they lurk around the corridors, putting drips on people, giving medications, causing the trouble, and then they go off in the morning, and the day staff are left to pick up the pieces. And of course, the day staff, I think, cannot point a finger, because they'll lose their job. I can understand that they're frightened themselves.
And coming in on this, I met someone senior who... the junior doctors are left with a very peculiar situation. They want to do as much good as they can, and they're forced into... they're forced into a very difficult situation where someone who is a senior position in the hospital above them asks them to put people on what is basically a pathway to death. And the junior doctors don't understand why they should do it, and they are left bullied and pushed and very troubled by this. And I think it's something which needs to be brought up, because the junior doctors are fighting against something else which is in place, and they are very troubled by it. And, you know, when I heard about it, I've met people, there is people in senior positions who have had financial incentives to do things about the pathway, and they are in charge now, and they are looking after other people who keep putting other people on that pathway.
Yes.
You know, Brian, it's they are some very good people in the NHS. The
most of them are. It's a very peculiar small number in
yes.
senior positions who should be removed.
Okay.
Well, when I was in hospital...
We're a little eye on the time, because we're just a little bit over 50 minutes, so and I'm going to say to you now, I would very much like to be able to continue this subject, because there's a lot of information
there's a part
which
two.
We can talk about, and we can bring in other cases mm-hmm. as well to
Brian,
support it. So
Brian, can I just say one thing about the care home situation? My mother's previous care home, before she was in the one that sent her to hospital, it opened in September 2013. It was closed by its company, Four Seasons Healthcare, in December 2015. So it was opened just a little over 2 years. There were 56 complaints to the CQC. 7 of those were whistleblowing. There was 37 safeguardings against that home. There was multiple residents with multiple unknown caused injuries treated by the doctor's surgery that was connected to that care home. The doctor's surgeries that are connected to care homes seem to be, only in my experience, their loyalty is to the care home, not the patient. They're not there to protect the patient. They get paid extra money by the care home. Why would their loyalty be with the patient? That's the first thing. The doctor in court, when I was taken to the Court of Protection, accused by the very perpetrators in this home who committed abuse and neglect, said that she didn't know about any of the other residents that had unknown caused injuries. How can a surgery not know about its patients having unknown caused injuries that are all at the same surgery and all from the same care home that's next door?
Well, that is a question which absolutely needs to be answered, and I take your point.
Hang
on, I just have to finish. While we were having the complaints at that care home, and while I was being taken to court, the local authority had that home under serious service level investigation from June 2014, probably until December 2015 when it closed. Everybody has refused to give us the outcome of that investigation. They would not admit there was institutional abuse and neglect at that care home. Now, this is where we have no power. Somebody should be asking what the outcome of that investigation was. I wrote to my MP and I wrote to local councillors. They've done absolutely nothing to find out what the result is of that investigation. In fact, they haven't even responded.
Okay, and that is a very familiar comment with regard to MPs. Okay, thank you for that. Mark, I'm just going to ask you, just as closing remarks, and we are going to, we will do more on this, but just for this particular episode to close off, what do you think is going on? Is this just incompetence within the NHS? What
no.
is actually causing these incidents and this problem?
I think, unfortunately, there's two elements running in the background. One, they want a plan to sell the NHS off. To sell the NHS off to investors, it has to be squeaky clean and nice and easy to sell. The problem you've got then is somewhere in the past, they introduced something called the Liverpool Care Pathway, which was rolled out all over the country, which through law allowed food and drink to be removed from individuals.
Still does.
And it's still active. And by removing food and drink from individuals, they died and then they were cremated and it was all covered up because they didn't want to admit what there was going on was that thing. But the problem is they want to sell the hospitals off, and therefore what you've got is police, coroners, other people in authority, you know, all sorts of committees, and the message to them is quite simple. If you want to keep your jobs, if you want to try and get other better jobs, do not rock the boat for the sale of the hospitals. Therefore, the hospitals can have loads of mistakes going on, but they're all being missed out. They're not being really properly corrected. And because the staff flow between hospitals and care homes, it means everything is, at the moment, it looks like it's very bad. And that's one of the, that's two parts of the explanation. One, they're trying to sell the hospital services off because they're worth a fortune as a business. And the other part is that the thing called Liverpool Care Pathway, which we can show in 2013, 130,000 people went on it in a year, and they may not have needed to be. Many people were put on the pathway, took off the pathway, who were successful at getting removed from the pathway, lived on afterwards. My problem is, when I come to talk to people in Chester, is their father, mother, whatever, fit as a fiddle, climbs the stairs, no problems, plays tennis, they go in for an average checkup, and then for some reason they deteriorated in Chester Hospital or whatever, and they died. And then the rest of it is cover-up. It is appalling what seems to be going on here. And you and I know a certain professor in medicine who has been looking at this. And the problem is with whistleblowers, they can only whistle so much where it threatens their job and their pension. Therefore, once again, the facts are being shut down and stopped, yeah?
Yes.
Brian, there's another issue, which I believe why it's going on.
I'm going to say very, very nicely, I think we need to end here. We're just coming up to an hour.
Okay, one last thing, Brian. Sorry. There aren't enough beds in this country for the people who need care home places. So why are they going to shut down care homes?
Okay. Well, final comment from me is that when I was travelling home from the office here, the studio here, the other day, I heard a government spokesperson, as they say, talking about the future deaths from dementia. And I thought that was an exceptionally interesting statement because I wasn't aware that dementia was a terminal illness in itself. And I wonder whether perhaps that government person was speaking out about something that they've been briefed on, but certainly I found that an alarming statement that a condition which can be very distressing and debilitating should be described as a terminal illness.
And hang on, the problem you've got here is you've got many people, and it's a well-known fact, being diagnosed having dementia when they probably have urinary tract infection or some other condition which is treatable, and with the right treatment, the so-called dementia symptoms vanish. The problem is the people are diagnosed as having dementia when it's something else, they're put in a nursing home, they have a chemical cosh put on them, and then they are trapped in the nursing home, and then the value of their property is equal to the value of the care they're going to get. And though they're chemically coshed and not aware of what's going on, strange enough, once the value of the property has been all used up to the amount of the care they need in the nursing home, they magically know to die.
Yes.
That is peculiar. And there's something, you know, we've both know people are talking about this. And the fact that there isn't more research or investigation by the police is deeply troubling, because then you've got lawyers who are buying up law firms, probate firms, who are gaining by it.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to say on that note, and coming up to the hour, thank you very, very much for taking us through that.
Brian.
We've ended really on some very serious questions, and we will do another session to have a look into this whole subject much deeper.
Brian, the other...
I'm going to say thank you to you, Shirley, and Sylvia.
Thank you.
And I hope that you will... We can have you back again to discuss this a bit more, because I know both of you are full of information.
Yes.
But we've only got so much time today.
Just regards dementia as an illness, if it's an illness and the government say it's an illness, then why are so many people not on NHS funding and having to fight for NHS funding? And as Mark says, they're taking their properties away because they're on social services funding. They've either got an illness or they haven't.
Indeed. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all very much for joining me with this. And I know... deeply disturbing subject, but of course it's a subject which affects every one of us, as we have fathers, mothers, aunts, uncles, but elderly people who are inevitably going to be part of the care system. So thank you very much.